Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
I'm Mike Boris, and this is Straight Talk.
Yeah. Why you do it then?
I think... Good question.
I'm going to take you live now. Following the arrest of two men on charges of insider trading.
...of approximately $7 million. The man obtained information from the Australian Bureau of Statistics employee, and he used that information to enter into foreign exchange derivatives.
The trial of Lucas to his friend Chris Ways.
The first, you know, 5 minutes of speaking to him, essentially we decided that I'd be pleading guilty. In that same five-minute conversation, it was like, you'll definitely be going to prison. That's when things really started to sink in.
How did you find it? He was scaling for himself.
I found out the day I was arrested. Yeah, that's when I heard about the, you know, $7.5 million
of profit.
Expected to see an equal profit sharing. We agreed to $200,000.
Altogether?
$200,000 over 12 months. You know, he's saying, we'll keep it small, under the radar.
Should you forgive him? Chris Hill, welcome to Straight Talk, mate.
Thanks, sir. Thanks for having me.
You've watched a couple of episodes?
Yeah, I've watched a few, listened to quite a few more. I actually only just found out that the whole thing was recorded. I'd always just listened to it on Spotify.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, someone told me that.
It's video.
Yeah, that's video.
So yeah, yeah. Like, and we do everything here, mate. Like, so we've got Chris Hill here sitting in front of me. And you know, I've talked to lots of different people who have done lots of weird and wonderful things in their life, but I really haven't spoken to anybody yet who's had the experience that you had. That is, I guess you're still a young man, but as a relatively young man at that time, being lured by the prospect of making money into disclosing something you should never have disclosed. So, and then of course you get caught and you get convicted and you did your time. And now you're out and you do a lot of speaking around this, and you do a lot of speaking to young people too, especially about the mistakes you've made.
Yeah, I've done a few in the past, some corporate stuff, but I like doing the stuff for universities, younger people, trying to maybe put a little bit of, you know, fear of God into them that, you know, these sorts of things can actually happen. And I really enjoy seeing the, you know, the reaction, seeing people understand that this, like, it is real, like it happens.
Yeah,
it's quite fulfilling.
You know, we watch the movie The Wolf of Wall Street, and we watch the movie Greed and all those sorts of things. And to some extent, we don't have that type of thing happen much here in Australia. We're certainly not on the fantastic basis. But for someone like me who's really interested in what happens in the Australian Bureau of Statistics, what happens at the Reserve Bank, and where interest rates are going to go, and what's going to happen with the Aussie dollar, and how data can affect these things, and or having the right amount of data can put you in a superior position. Like, to me, I'm fascinated, okay? I want to find out who Chris Hill was prior to all these things happening. Like, what's the deal? Where did you go to school? What was your deal? Normal family life, or were you one of these corrupted kids? What was the deal?
No, look, I think the Chris Hill back then is the same Chris Hill now, pretty much. You know, I had a pretty normal life growing up. You know, went to school in the eastern suburbs of Melbourne, and then moved to private school in that same area. Really enjoyed school, was, was very athletic, loved the sports. I found school pretty easy. I managed to get really good grades. Mathematics was always just, I could just do it. English and that wasn't great at, but still did okay. But maths and science and anything to do with numbers and things that you could have a definitive answer, that sort of thing for me just I found pretty easy.
And that got you into university?
Yeah, so that got me into university. Went to Monash, where I did double degree in commerce and economics. And that was probably when I got to uni. I turned 18 because I was only 17 when I started. And once I turned 18 and started going out, started driving, had a lot more freedom. I think the grades suffered a little bit. I was probably not as concerned about the marks and things that I had been at high school. And I had, I just had a really good time at uni, but did well enough to, thankfully to get offered a job at the ABS.
Yeah, so university has a way of, when you first go to university, especially if you come from a private school environment and a good family, it tends to challenge your reliance upon structure because there's no structure at university, basically. Yeah. You want to fuck it up, you fuck it up. If you want to do well, you do well. And you were doing a double degree, which is probably something you thought, oh, well, I'm sweet, I've always done well in my exams, I'll be all right, I'll leave things to the last minute. But, you get challenged. I mean, to be honest, exactly the same thing happened to me in my first semester at university. What were you hoping to do from the university degree that you were doing? You say you got a job offer from the ABS, but what do you come out as after having done commerce and economics?
Yeah, so I think the economics side I didn't enjoy as much. So I steered more towards the finance, which is obviously like under the commerce branch, as well as econometrics, which is sort of cross between statistics and economics. And that's where I really enjoyed. And I found it, as I said, with my maths background, I found that really rewarding and it all made sense to me. In that sense, through uni, I wanted to go into high corporate finance, banking, that sort of thing. I just didn't have the grades, basically. For the top tiers that I, envisioned myself going to, like probably everyone does when they go into finance.
You might remember in those days, Pete Melvin, Mitchell, Bryce Waterhouse, UBS. Glory Bank, whatever.
Yeah. I came to terms with that fairly quickly because I just knew that I just keep doing what I was doing and that I'd get somewhere at the end of it.
So the ABS, Australian Bureau of Statistics, recruits out of universities, lots of students. Did you end up getting an internship or they offered you a job?
No, it was just a straight job.
Yep. And what was your job
initially? Yeah, so I started basically in the what they call time series analysis. So basically there's a section that gathers all the data, does all the surveys, and brings it all into all the numbers, etc., and just as raw data. Now what time series analysis does is basically turns that data into something that is actually usable by the public. So if you think of retail sales, for example, there's no point saying, the sales have gone up from August to December because December's fucking Christmas, right? So sales always go up.
Of course they're going to go up.
Yeah. So seasonal analysis, in the name of it, we adjust for the seasons. We adjust for sort of one-off events and things.
Like you might be adjusting for Black Friday, for example.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So or something catastrophic happens somewhere, causes a massive spike in the data. We sort of remove that spike to give an underlying number that's
actually... Sort of normalize it.
Normalize it, yeah. Give a number that's comparable across the time periods.
Yeah, right. Okay. And if I just before you move on from there, go back to university just for a moment. We meet lots of different people at university who we didn't meet at school. We build out a brand new network. Who did you meet during that period?
I probably had five or six sort of reasonably close mates at university. But I didn't really socialize with those guys that much. I've always been really close with my high school mates, and still to today, you know, all my best mates are all, you know, from year seven. You know, I've known them all for 20 plus years. So yeah, there was probably four of us that sort of hung out.
Anyone in particular though?
Yeah, so Lucas, yeah, obviously I met Lucas there, and he, yeah, he was an interesting guy. You know?
What was he doing, the same course as you?
Yeah, he was doing the same course.
Double major?
Yeah, exact same course, and did a lot of the same subjects as me as well. So we did a lot of shoots together and that sort of thing. And
were you hanging out together?
Not really. Like a little bit. Like if there was you know, if there was a university social event, or you know, we had some time in between classes or whatever, go and, you know, kick the footy or have lunch or something like that. But nothing really like outside of university.
Did anything strike you about his personality?
Character? I think the main thing that sort of gets you with Lucas is he's just how excitable he is. And he's just on all the time, you know. And it's just really like in your face, on, excited about everything. It doesn't matter what the topic is. It's
he's passionate.
He's just passionate, and he loves just talking about anything and everything. And you know, he has a really good general knowledge of most topics.
Yeah. Would you call him attractive? Like in the sense that he's a person that attracts people's attention and attracts you to want to talk to him or be around him. Maybe not necessarily at the pub, but just generally.
I think certain people, but I think also he probably rubs a lot of people the wrong way as well. Probably I'd say a lot of people would find him quite arrogant to the point that they may not want to have or continue conversations with him.
As an opinionated?
Just maybe a little like overbearing, a little, you know, when you just want to have like a casual conversation, you've got that one person who takes it like really, really seriously and really intense, and it's just, you know, just
too much.
Just calm it down.
Yeah. You know? So yeah, I know those people. So and so you're in the ABS and you're working in the time series analysis. So what were you looking at in the terms of the time series analysis? What data sets?
Yeah, so retail sales is one of the big ones. Building approvals. The labor force, so employment data, unemployment
wages,
rate, wages, all those sorts of the probably the big like leading indicators, the major announcements that come from those we pretty much worked on, either, you know, directly from myself or someone within our reasonably small team.
Yeah. And when you join up something like the ABS, and I've always been fascinated by this because, you know, the ABS puts out its, releases data, I don't know, some things monthly, some things quarterly, but it has its own rhythm. And a lot of these things are really relevant to how inflation gets addressed by the RBA, and more relevant how markets react in terms of the Aussie dollar. It could be the Aussie dollar. It could be... you know, interest rate trades, it could be share market, et cetera. So, and as I understand it, correct me if I'm wrong, but the ABS only, everybody in the whole world, including the government, the treasurer, the prime minister, the governor of the RBA, we all see the numbers on the same day, the results on the same day. ABS sort of just puts it out on the website, abs.com, australianstatistics.com.au, and the whole world sees it on the same day. Did the ABS... when they recruit you, sort of tell you like, hey guys, anything you see here has got to be kept in house. I mean, and how hard is it to control that? I mean, how do they work all that? Or do they break it up such that you only see little bits? I mean, how does it all work?
Yeah, it's a good question because like, I don't really remember there being any sort of emphasis on that.
Disclosure.
Yeah. Like I think like maybe the first day, when you sign your contract or whatever, you probably sign something. It's little print or whatever saying don't do this, don't do that. But yeah, I think they just, they'd never really, I guess, come across something like that. And then I think because of that, they probably just didn't really have much in place. And you're right, because there would be hundreds and hundreds of people there who would have access prior, you know, 2 to 3 weeks sometimes. And it may not be, you know, 2 weeks out, the data might not be the final number, but generally it's going to be close enough to, if you want to do what you want to do. So yeah, they had a few like measures in place, but it wasn't really.
And would you have to go and hunt, for example, if you're working in the time series analysis of the data for example, for the unemployment number, which is particularly important at the moment in Australia when it comes to the Reserve Bank's position relative to what they're going to do with interest rates. It's one of the big ones they look at, along with the wage price index. But would any person be in a position to see what is going to be within a range of variation, but like what will the final number be? Or do they sort of have everybody broken up into different parts? And so like no one person at the ABS could actually gather this information?
For example, I could see everything.
Because you could just access on the...
Yeah, I mean, like my job is literally to come up with that final number.
Right.
Essentially.
Right, okay. So you were the guy who had the final number. But they didn't split you up.
No.
So it wasn't 10 of you or 6 of you?
Oh, well, I mean, like anyone, really anyone in my team could jump on and see that.
They had access to it.
Yeah.
Like authorization.
Yeah.
And I mean, today, this is a while ago, we're talking about when this all happened, but today, just in my environment, our compliance department is just all over everybody, like for data, information, but like nothing should leak out. And everything's being continually audited, both in a software sense and in a physical sense by internal auditors. Did the ABS have big compliance departments that you knew about? Can we say, let's have a look at your file here, Chris. What are you doing?
Yeah, no, not that I ever remembered. I don't think I ever had any sort of interaction with anyone. I think probably the big difference is like when you're talking about, you know, data and data leaks and things, like a lot of the ones you hear about is, you know, massive files on clients and this sort of thing.
Yeah.
Except at the ABS, what you're talking about is like a single number, you know, so it's something that, like, for example, I couldn't take all the client data out in my head. I'd have to do something like put it on a USB or like send it out somewhere or whatever. And I think the difference with this is, if you can remember one or two numbers, that's it. And it's I guess a different type of privacy breach than what's normally talked about in that sense.
So how old were you when you were sort of in this position?
21.
Pretty young.
21 to 24.
Pretty young.
Yeah.
Like very young.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you see there's no big brother looking over your shoulder and you see this information. Were you aware enough as a 21, 22, 23, 24-year-old, were you aware enough of an opportunity that might exist if you had this information?
I had no idea. But back then, no idea.
No idea.
Because there was no link between what, or at least at the ABS, between, I guess, what we were doing and the actual announcements coming out. You know, it was like our team was very much, all right, like this is, we're doing our part, and then it goes on to the next department and they do the releases. And so there was never like really a great connect between those two. At least not in my eyes. It was never something I'd looked into, really. So, I mean, yeah, it would have been obvious for someone who was in knowledge and in that sort of sector or whatever. But for me, it didn't mean anything really, at the time.
So take me to the obvious place. I mean, can build a bridge for me here. Like, did Lucas contact you and say, hey, mate, what are you doing? I mean, how'd that all come about? Like,
Yeah. Essentially, we were just chatting.
Where? At the pub or something?
We were chatting down at the beach.
Bumped into him?
No, we had a birthday party for a university mate down at a holiday house on the coast somewhere. We were just chatting about our work, what we were doing, and you know he was at NAB at the time, and working on the foreign exchange desk.
Which means what?
So, I mean, he was essentially, he was right in there on the, you know, the dealing desk, dealing with the, you know, the big banks, et cetera, putting big trades on for them, et cetera, in the foreign exchange market.
But basically dealing in foreign currencies.
Exactly, yeah.
Relative to Australian currencies.
Yeah. So not just Australian, but you know, any sort of international currency.
Yeah, so if he was instructed to buy US dollars, he bought it with Australian dollars.
Yeah.
But there's always a better time to buy or a better price to buy at based on how markets set prices.
Yeah.
And to some extent, you know, banks set prices to some extent because if their trades are big enough. But generally speaking, they're always trying to do the best deal possible. Buy as cheap as possible. And to some extent, they get recognized internally for how well they do and can get a reputation for how well they do. So he's telling you that's what he's doing. He's working on the foreign exchange desk of a bank, major bank. You tell him what you're doing. Did the light bulb go off on anybody at that point?
I mean, for him, it was straight away.
Well, did you see it? Do you remember the moment? Did you see... You knew him well enough. I mean, did you see his excitement, or was he just always excited?
He got very excited. Yeah, but it sort of seemed like a joke, you know. At the time, it was like, you know, it was like, oh, you know, we should like, you know, we can use that and like make heaps of money, and like, and we were all drinking and laughing, and you know, it was like, certainly didn't seem to me like a serious conversation. You know, it was just everyone's just talking shit. Basically,
yeah, typical young guys.
A bunch of guys drinking and carrying on.
So I hope you don't mind me asking these detailed questions, but like, I'm just intrigued as how do these things sort of evolve and how they're built. At what point did he say, "Hey, mate"? Did he ring you back up and say, "Mate, let's have a coffee"? Like, without all the other boys being around and girls, let's just sit down and talk this through. What happened?
Yeah, I think. I think it was probably a few weeks later or something, and he called me and we had a bit of a conversation, and then it kind of started to sink in that he was actually sort of serious about this, and that I guess he explained it to me because, you know, like I said, back then I wasn't in that industry and I didn't really understand how it worked or what, you know, to what extent – you know, these releases meant for those sorts of markets. I just had no idea back then. So, yeah, we met probably back in Melbourne a couple of times and went over essentially what, you know, he was suggesting we could do with, you know, a small amount of, you know, startup money, so you call it, yeah.
So can you just tell me what you guys concocted then? Do you mind telling me? What did you decide to do?
Yeah, so we basically decided that we would put 10 grand into a CFD account with a broker and with a foreign exchange broker. And basically it was pretty simple. It would be he gave me a few of the announcements that, you know, he said were significant. You know, the retail sales, unemployment was always the massive one. Interest rates, you know, CPI data, I never had access to. So that was just, I guess, out of the question. But yeah, so the employment rate, et cetera. And yeah, he just said, you know, if you give me the information, you know, a day or two before or whenever you get it, he said he'll put the trades on because he'll know which way it's gonna move when the announcement comes out, and then he'll sell it afterwards. And should be able to make, I think we agreed to 200 grand at the time.
All together?
Altogether 200 grand.
Let's make 200 grand.
Let's make 200 grand over 12 months. You know, he's saying we'll keep it small, under the radar in this, you know, in this industry, it's a tiny amount of money. You know, it won't, you know, 10 grand here, 20 grand there. It's nothing in that. It's not going to go noticed.
Yeah, you're not going to make 20 grand in one shot. You're going to make 10 grand, 20 grand, just build it up. Yep. Just do the trades, little odd trades, look like you're lucky.
Yep.
And get a couple hundred grand. And what were you going to do with your 100?
Like, what,
I mean, do you have a plan?
Yeah, no, not really. Like even back then, even as a, you know, 24-year-old, it was never going to be a life-changing amount of money. You know, because, you know, we even talked about, oh, he'll have to pay tax, and then, you know what, there's like 50, 60 grand left each or whatever. So,
why are you doing that?
A good question. I think for me it was a bit of a thrill initially, and it was a real sense of like achievement in a way. It was like something we'd discuss, we'd put into plan, and then started doing it, and you know, and it was working, it was successful, and it was a good feeling, and I think that's why I kept doing it, at least on my part, because it was a sense of achievement, something that
immeasurable.
Yeah, and something that you know, just that we'd done ourselves from nothing, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's sort of like a startup in some respects.
Yeah, a little bit. It was like a little startup. Yeah.
And did you get closer to him? Did you become better mates?
Not really. I mean, I was always in Canberra. He was back in Melbourne, and the only conversation we'd literally have is like I'd call him once a month, or a couple of times a month, depending on when the announcements were going to come out, and just give him the figures, and that was it.
Didn't you ring up and say, hey, mate, we smashed it. We just made our best week.
I mean, he'd typically call me the night after and let me know how much money he'd made. Well, at least tell me how much
money you made.
Yeah, wasn't telling me how much money he'd made. But that was it. There was still never any, you know, social interactions or catching up really, apart from, you know, one or two times back in Melbourne. But that was it.
So tell me, what was he doing on the side?
Yeah, so he'd opened up two or three other accounts, and you know, instead of putting on small trades making 10, 20 grand, he was putting on very, very substantial trades and making, you know, hundreds of thousands in a few seconds, up to half a million, a million, you know, within 30 seconds, a minute, sort of thing. At the end, that's the scale it was, but yeah, the reporting back to me was, you know, we're up to 80 grand, 90 grand.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Whatever. And, you know, still for me, like I didn't, you know, I still, like I left all the trading and all that to him. I didn't understand it at that time. I didn't really have an interest in it. And so, it was very easy for me to just believe that. I didn't know that it could scale to that extent, I guess.
How did you find out he was scaling for himself?
I found out the day I was arrested.
Oh, you didn't know?
I didn't know.
Did you ever get any of the money out of your trades? Did you ever actually withdraw any of the money out of the however much money you guys are going to make?
I got 20 grand cash.
You took 20 grand out?
Yeah.
And the rest of it was just stayed in there for trading, for working capital?
Basically, yeah. 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 But
what was he doing with his money, do you know?
He was making some pretty big purchases. He bought one of the apartments from the block, or the winning apartment from the series of the block. I don't think he was. I mean, that was obviously splashing out. But I don't think apart from that, he wasn't really splashing out too much. At least from what I've heard. I do know there was definitely a lot of talks about purchases and things, but I think in that sense, again, all the money was still just sitting in one of the trading accounts.
So how did you come undone? How did the whole thing just sort of fall apart? What happened?
We got reported to ASIC.
Who reported you though?
So he was head of sales, Joel Murphy. He was head of sales at Pepperstone. And he, either himself or the risk team would have picked up the trades as an anomaly.
Why were they anomaly though?
They're anomaly in the sense of the amount of money being made. For a start, this is a retail broker. This is not, institutional. So, at a retail broker, anything sort of over 10, 20, 30 grand is a reasonably large amount of money. So the fact that, he was making hundreds of thousands per trade, wasn't losing very often. There were a few sort of dummy trades that were placed to potentially make the trading look more normalized. But just the sheer scale of it would have had everyone looking into it. And, it would have been, from their point of view, very obvious with the fact that all the trades were done over these major news announcements.
I wanted to ask you, Chris, so on the account that you guys had, did it have your personal name?
It was under his name.
Under his name, yeah. So they wouldn't have known if they're looking at the account that, oh, hang on, there's this guy called Chris who's working at the ABS.
No.
So they wouldn't have put that part together?
No, so everything, everything was just under Lucas's name. I think they looked him up on social media just to, say, oh, who's this guy? How's he got so much money? And then there was a connection made between me on his, I think, Facebook or LinkedIn about where I worked, which was ABS. And then I think they put two and two together. And ASIC was contacted at that point, and then ASIC escalated to AFP.
Yeah. So, so your undoing was social media at the end of the day. linking him to you through social media, and then looking at your LinkedIn account or something along those lines.
Something like that.
Yeah. Then that's a typical sort of compliance process.
Yeah.
And this is the compliance at the broker.
Yeah.
So the brokers, because they're always checking these things out, especially when a couple of young guys are doing so well, like it looks a bit odd.
Yeah.
And the anomaly that you're talking about is here's a young guy killing it. Outward signs of Ferraris or whatever. He wasn't actually, the Wolf of Wall Street in some respects. I mean, he wasn't out there smoking cigars and snorting cocaine in public or something like that. He wasn't doing that shit. But they just did their normal compliance checks, and then they found the both of you. Did ASIC talk to you, or did the AFP come straight up?
Well, it was both ASIC and AFP, like joint investigation.
So what happened? Remember the day?
Yeah, I remember the day.
Or night. Where do they come in, on a Saturday, Sunday, Monday?
They came in on a Friday morning at about 4 a.m., I think.
4 a.m.?
Yeah.
Coming to your house?
Yeah, came to my apartment in Canberra. I think I only got home at about 2.
Oh.
I was pretty rough. And just obviously lots of banging and screaming, yelling to open the door. I came in with, I don't know, 5 or 6 of them, and then they brought a dog in, or a couple of dogs. And even when they, you know, they first started talking to me, showed me the search warrant. Initially, I honestly thought that they'd come to the wrong house. I think probably a combination of being in shock.
And probably
still a little intoxicated potentially. And it was only, when I started reading through the actual search warrant, that, you know, I just kind of dropped and I was like, shit, this is a...
Did they handcuff you?
They took me back to one of the stations there. And that was when I was in the back of the car that it actually came onto the radio. And that's when I heard about the, you know, $7.5 million
of
profits. And so that was me hearing the amounts for the first time. And initially, though, I was just like, oh, that's media. You know, that's nowhere near $7.5 million. Like, you know. But then it was, you know, an interview with AFP, which was just on a no comment interview on my behalf. They were then talking about the amounts of money and this sort of thing, and that's when things, I guess, for me started to click that this is potentially a lot bigger than I
thought. Did you get a lawyer?
I did, yeah.
Straight away? Who'd you ring?
Who did I ring? I mean, I didn't know a lawyer. I didn't need a lawyer. I spoke to mum and dad that night. I'd been locked up at that point in like a holding cell underneath one of the courts in Canberra. I spoke to them. Didn't say too much really, but the main gist of the conversation was that can you sort a lawyer out essentially, because up until that point I had spoken to a lawyer, but it was just like he just said, just shut up, don't say anything, and that was about it.
So did you get bail?
I got bail after 2 days. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the first night I was in Canberra, and then they flew me to Melbourne the next day.
Handcuffed?
No. So, but it was interesting going through the airport because there was, you know, there was media and cameras everywhere, and then they took, they took me to sort of a area away from the public, and you know, we got on the plane last. I think we actually went, I mean, I remember going through some like tunnels or something and popping up somewhere and then going to the back of the plane when everyone was like already on board.
So you weren't hanging out in the lounge?
Wasn't hanging out in the lounge, no free drinks, unfortunately. But yeah, then one of the AFP blokes with me like was reading the paper, and then it was like front page. Yeah.
How did you feel? At that stage, I mean, by this stage, you've got to have your hangover, I guess. Well, maybe you didn't. But how did you feel? Like, what was going through your head?
I think obviously I knew it was very serious at that point. But I reckon I was still very much in shock. Things definitely hadn't sunk in, and probably didn't for a couple of days. Probably once I got bail and went to see the barrister that had been organised, that's when things really started to sink in, and the gravity of the situation. You know, in the first, you know, 5 minutes of speaking to him, essentially we decided that I'd be pleading guilty. You know, and in that same 5 minute conversation, it was like, you'll definitely be going to prison. So,
and what was the charge? The actual charge or charges?
There was initially about 15. You know, when they throw everything at it. But what it boiled down to was insider trading, which was obviously the big one. Abuse of public office. That was for the breaching of information from the ABS. And then use of identity information, which was essentially using a phone that was in someone else's name.
Right, so you had like a burner?
Like a burner phone, yeah.
You had one, use it to correspond with him?
Yeah, we did, yeah. Not from the start, I think he registered them a few months in under, I think, someone from work or something, and just gave me one of them when we were in Melbourne. It seemed, I don't know, to me it seemed very like over the top at the time, but because I think back then, like the seriousness of what we were doing probably to me wasn't that apparent.
Can I ask you a question? Do you put that down to naivety, or do you put that down to, is that your personality? You don't really register the importance of things?
I think there's probably a little bit of both. Like initially, obviously there was a lot of me thinking back and forth about the consequences, etc. And like I definitely knew that what we were doing was illegal, like 100%, and I knew that. So it took a long time for us to start the process, probably because of me. But then once we did, it very quickly just molded into like a habit.
Business as usual.
Yeah. And
You weren't getting a high off it?
No, I wasn't getting a high, but it was when you make a decision over and over again with zero consequences, it stops becoming a decision.
Yeah.
You just do it.
Yeah, it's a bit like if you like to do coke every Friday night, and every Friday night you ring up your coke supplier and he turns up and you buy the coke and he gives you the coke and you snort the gram with your mates and you cost you whatever it costs you for whatever it is, and then you do the exact next Friday, nothing ever happens. No bad consequences. It just becomes, that's what I do Friday nights.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mates, get pissed, drink vodkas and do coke.
And I mean, you know, if that's what you're doing, you know, probably the first time you do it, you're very hesitant.
Yeah.
Like you said, after that, you just do it.
Yeah, it's interesting how the brain works. And once the risk goes out of it, because it's what you do and nothing, no consequences, you just keep doing it.
Yeah.
Other people, though, do it for the thrill. So, I mean, that's not you, though. You were saying, I'm not a thrill seeker as such. Do you think he was doing it for the thrill? Because he's obviously dealing in much larger numbers.
I think probably a little bit of the thrill for him, but I think very much the money was the big impact for him. It was a pure, you know, it was a pure business, not business, but you know what I mean. It was a transaction that would
enrich him.
That would enrich him, and you know, if all went well, he would come out potentially with $10 million.
Yeah,
or more.
Yeah. So because that was the thing I was going to ask you. I mean, do you think, did you at any time or did you at all times do this out of enrichment or just because I want to enrich myself, because we're only talking about 50 grand, potentially half the tax, and you only have got 20 of it. Was that your thinking for enrichment, using information illegally gotten for my own personal enrichment, or was it, I'm doing it just because we talked about it and I'm doing it?
Yeah, it wasn't the money was small, and I knew that. I think for me it was it goes back to that sense of achieving something, and it it felt good that it was successful.
You're a winner.
Yeah. It was, again, like putting something in place, you know, executing it, being successful. And there was probably a small part that was like, oh, you know, other people like that I'm working with, they're not doing this, you know, it's just me doing it, you know. And it was, it was a good feeling, but monetary wise for me, wasn't really a driving factor probably initially, you know, the thought of, oh, you know, at 22 or whatever I was, you know, come out with 50 grand. I mean, great. But as it continued, yeah, it was more about that success.
So you both get nailed. I presume he got nailed as well at the same time. You find out that he's been doing big trades. It's the anomalous nature of the trades, particularly given they were larger trades, and the anomaly that they were mostly successful, that sort of drew the eye of the compliance department for the trading accounts, that sort of created the investigation, which created the outcome, which you end up getting charged for and convicted for. Did you at any stage think, what a fucking idiot, like, why did he do that? Did you ever think that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And did you say anything to him?
We obviously discussed it. But I mean, I didn't see him like until we were convicted, basically. We weren't allowed to have contact.
Yeah.
During our time on bail. And I think that, yeah, the first time in one of the first court appearances after we got remanded, then we were both in the holding cell together, you know, and it was just sort of like an icebreaker. He was just sort of like, well, I fucked that up, you know.
Oh, he made the admission.
Yeah, he was just like, yeah, I really fucked that up. And, but, I mean, yes, I was pissed off, of course. But there was just so much other shit that I was dealing with that it was like my, you know, feelings towards him at that point just seemed so insignificant to everything else that was happening.
You're about to do time.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. That I just didn't have the energy to, you know, to even go down that path.
So did you forgive him?
Yeah, I mean, I honestly don't have ill feelings towards him.
You don't, you won't hang out with him. Is he still in jail, or is he out?
No, he's out now, and no, I haven't seen him
How long did you stay in jail for?
I was sentenced to 3.5 years, and I did my minimum of 2 years.
2 years. So you did 2 years. How'd you do that? Tough? I mean, where was it?
First 4 months was probably the hardest, because that was on remand. So if you're on remand, you've got to be in max. So the first 4 months was pretty tough. After we got sentenced, I got moved to a minimum security place, and that was definitely a lot better. Still a really shit place to be. But certainly from the first 4 months, it was a vast improvement. And you know, I basically just kept as busy as possible. I was doing some uni courses through sort of correspondence, that sort of thing, and I was writing lots of letters, going to the gym like every day religiously, getting really fit. You had to work. I was working as a baker in the kitchen there, making, you know, a few hundred loaves of bread a day, and just then at night times. So I was just busy all the time, and that's probably how I coped with it.
Did he get a longer sentence than you?
Yeah, so he got 7.5 to serve 4.5.
So he got 7.5 on the top and 4.5 on the bottom.
Yeah, so he got essentially double what I got. Yeah.
And did you have to give anything? Did you feel compelled at any stage? I mean, did you have to give evidence against him, like that would have made his sentence longer?
Not really, because we both pleaded guilty basically right at the start. We obviously did have interviews to get everything straight as to what happened, but it was all, you know, essentially everything just...
The facts were agreed.
The facts were all agreed. It was there really was nothing contested at that point. And then it was really just a matter of sentencing at that point. They were obviously pretty upset.
But what was they upset about? I mean, obviously they'd be disappointed what you did all that sort of stuff. But like, what have you talked about it with them? What was the big deal like for them, really?
I think they were worried more than anything else. I think the way, probably the way it happened, the way they found out about it was obviously a massive shock. I mean, it's never going to be an easy phone call to make or get or see in the paper or whatever it is. So that was probably one of the worst parts. But then I think, you know, my lawyer was really, really good as far as putting everyone at ease as much as possible. Really good at like talking through the processes, next steps, what's going to be happening, what to expect, all that sort of thing. So I guess things were done to make that as easy as possible in a difficult time.
So here we go. We got it. You've been convicted. You did your time. You know, what are you doing with yourself now then?
I'm actually working for the guy who is, who basically reported to ASIC initially.
Really?
So he started his own broker probably 7 or 8 years ago. And after I did a podcast a few years ago, he was on the podcast for a little bit as well. He said he wanted to catch up with me. We basically chatted, and he offered me a job. it's quite ironic, and I've been there for almost 3 years now. So,
what are you doing? So, data analytics, or
it's in the risk side. So, yeah, it's about as ironic as you can get, I guess.
The risk being you're working in the department where the part of the business, I should say, where they are assessing risks of people like yourself.
Yeah, I mean that's one part of the job, is looking for I guess suspicious type
irregularity.
Yeah. Irregularity, suspicious trading, not necessarily illegal, but frowned upon, card counting type, situations. And also, you know, that other risks like hedging of our trades and that sort of thing. So there's a lot of data involved, yes. So I'm definitely still, I guess, using that, that knowledge that I learnt, through uni, through the ABS, just the applications, vastly different, obviously, to what I was doing previously.
And are you doing anything else in relation to, apart from this podcast? I mean, are you talking to people? I mean, you're helping others out. You sort of passing on your experience to others.
Yeah, I try to do as much as I can, or at least I take the opportunities when they come. I'm not actively, I guess, marketing it out and trying to, but I certainly love, I've got quite a few contacts through universities now that, and I might do, you know, two or three of those sorts of talks a year. And they're the ones I really like doing at the universities. I have also been trying to write a book. And I say trying because at the moment it's just basically everything that pops into my head, I'm just back from that time until now, essentially, and just putting it down. But it's, I'm finding it quite challenging. But
writing is hard.
Yeah.
And what have you learned about yourself from this whole experience? Because you're still only a relatively young man.
Yeah, I think like I've definitely learned a lot of resilience. That's probably a big one. The other big one for me is probably just how important like the decision making process, like we were talking about before, and how the brain can play such a big impact in some of these, you know, potentially life changing decisions that you make. So like one of the other things I was doing is designing a course around risk-taking and decision-making, and it's all about how process information, how when you come across new scenarios, that if you don't literally sit back and think about every possible situation that can happen and how likely it is to happen, that there's no way you can make a good decision if you don't do that. But what you find is that most people don't, and that's
especially young people.
Yeah, you know, limited life experience at that point. And yeah, it's one of the things that I guess is I'm quite passionate about, and I'm hoping to get that finished and then do some more presentations on that and send it out to people.
Well, we often hear about jail doesn't rehabilitate people, and I'm sure it doesn't in a lot of cases. But Chris Hill, it seems to me that in your circumstances, you are rehabilitated. And I mean, I'm not making a judgment. It just seems that way to me. And that you are trying to make lead a different life, and you've learned from what you did. And I really appreciate your honesty and your frankness. And you know, just sitting down talking to someone like you, I can see how that sort of thing can happen. I just, especially when you're 20, 21, 22, 23, the front of your brain's not even properly developed, the part that makes the decisions.
Yeah.
And some people, it doesn't develop probably into mid-20s. And who knows, any one of us could have done something similar if the seduction had been put in front of us at the time. Yeah, any one of us. Yeah, with testosterone flashing around the joint, to, you know, appetite to risk, relative to decision-making, ability. Lots of people can make mistakes, and it's good actually to talk to someone like you who's made the mistake and, you know, acknowledges it, and but actually tells us about the experience in proper, like real terms, what actually happened. So, mate, good luck to you, and thanks very much for coming and being so honest.
No, thank you. Appreciate it. Cheers, Mark.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.